Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.8, Battle of Navarino, the Greek Revolution, Part 6. Last time, we left off with the Siege of Missolonghi, which in many ways represented the true low point of Greek fortunes during the War for Independence, and it had been a war full of many low points. And things were looking pretty grim at this point, as Ibrahim Pasha's Egyptian army had now pretty much retaken the entire Peloponnese, which had, for most of the struggle, been the stronghold and place of refuge for the Greeks. Then, after the fall of Missolonghi, the Ottomans controlled most of mainland Greece, with Athens being the last stronghold under revolutionary control. After taking Missolonghi, though, Kutahil Pasha then headed straight for Athens and put the Acropolis under siege. The rebels would hold out atop the ancient fortress for almost a year by launching night raids against the Ottomans and by creating intricate underground tunnel networks to sneak people and supplies in and out. Much like Missolonghi, the siege of the Acropolis was a dramatic episode full of heroism and self-sacrifice, and the shared hardships endured during both of these sieges increased the solidarity amongst many Greeks. But the siege of the Acropolis was really just another tiny blip of resistance within a wave of Ottoman reconquest. Once the Ottomans did take Athens in the spring of 1827, there were really only a handful of islands such as Idra, home of the Kondoriotis brothers, which remained under Greek control. There were, of course, many fighters, klephs, armatholos, and chieftains in the Peloponnese and western Greece still holed up in the mountains, but they were being slowly driven out as Ibrahim's army devastated the land they conquered in a deliberate effort to sap the Greeks' will to fight. Ibrahim was executing a devastating scorched earth campaign during which he would enslave thousands of Greek soldiers and civilians and displace no less than a third of the inhabitants of the Peloponnese, who were left homeless after seeing their villages burned to the ground. Ibrahim's strategy of terror was working, and many, many people were either fleeing from Greece or laying down their arms and submitting to the Sultan. So, what's going on here? I thought that the Greek Revolution ended with an independent Greece, and this is our last episode on the Greek Revolution. So, what? The Ottomans are about to win? Well, yes, they are in fact about to win, which is what makes what is about to happen all the more extraordinary. As we have talked about over the past two episodes, the Greek cause had over the years increasingly become a cause that European public opinion, and especially liberal public opinion, was getting behind. Something that is a little hard for us to understand during our time is that this thing called public opinion was sort of new. Now, this is not to say that people outside the halls of government haven't always had opinions about certain issues. Of course they have. But public opinion as a force driving politics was at this point pretty new. The French Revolution, which was the event that opened the floodgates of European liberalism and nationalism, had only happened 30 years ago at this point. And while the Siege of Missolonghi was going on during 1825 and 1826, the plight of the town was increasingly taking the front page as headline news in places like England, the German states, Russia, and most especially France. The siege as a sensational news story was sort of a perfect storm, because at this point, Lord Byron had already made the town famous when he had died there. And then afterwards, the story of Lord Byron's death was romantically retold as a heroic defense of Missolonghi. So the town's name was already on the tip of everyone's tongue when the stories we discussed last time started flooding the newsstands about how the town's inhabitants, just like Byron, had selflessly sacrificed themselves for the liberty of the Greek nation. Then, further stories of how Ibrahim's Egyptian army had massacred and enslaved the innocent townspeople who were forced to remain behind made the plight of the Greeks a humanitarian crisis that was increasingly becoming impossible for the governments of Europe to continue to ignore. In this way, the siege and sortie of Missolonghi brought Philhellenism out of just being a cause for like romantic artists or for Napoleonic veterans, but was now even getting support from conservative monarchists who saw the saving of a fellow Christian people being tortured and enslaved as kind of like a quasi-medieval mission or like a modern crusade. Interestingly, the cause of the Greeks even began to become entangled with another major focal point of European humanitarianism at this time, abolitionism, which had similarly been fueled by this newfangled thing called public opinion, due to the fact that a huge part of the outrage against Ottoman repression of the Greeks centered around their enslavement specifically. Because Ibrahim Pasha's scorched earth campaign to retake the Peloponnese had led to the enslavement of thousands of mostly women and children, the enslavement of the Greeks became the principal rallying cry for pro-interventionist politics of the time. Now, this overlap between Philhellenism and abolitionism really gets to the heart of all of the deep contradictions present within the 19th century politics of the Atlantic world. There were many Philhellenes who were like legit abolitionists, wanting to see an end to the enslavement of all people, regardless of their race. But on the other hand, there were many other Philhellenes who were hypocritically outraged by Greek enslavement, specifically because it represented the enslavement of white Europeans at the hands of African Egyptians. To give you an idea of these contradictions, and to give you a feel for just how widespread support for the Greeks had become at this point, having now even moved across the Atlantic into the Americas, some of the people who are now publicly supporting the Greek cause included Jean-Pierre Boyer, the president of the newly liberated nation of Haiti, the first country in the world to abolish slavery, Thomas Jefferson, a plantation owner with over 500 enslaved people, Jonathan Miller and Sam Gridley Howe, both ardent American abolitionists who, like Lord Byron, actually fought in the Greek War of Independence. Then William Lloyd Garrison was himself a passionate Philhellene, and he nearly went over to Greece when he was a young man. And perhaps most remarkably, within the Monroe Doctrine that was promulgated during the Greek struggle in 1823, which specifically spoke against European intervention into the affairs of the Americas, President Monroe and Secretary of State John Quincy Adams went out of their way to mark Greece as an exception to this stance against intervention, feeling that they had to clearly establish their position in support of an independent Greece. And then in Europe, news of the siege of Missolonghi had led to an explosion of artistic representations of the Greek War that included multiple paintings by the French Romantic painter Eugène Delacroix, whose most famous work depicting the July Revolution of 1830, Liberty Leading the People, would actually hang in the throne room of King Louis-Philippe. But Delacroix actually first came to fame through his dramatic depictions of the massacre of the Greeks on the island of Chios, and then of the siege of Missolonghi itself. And I would highly recommend checking out Delacroix's paintings on the website 20thCenturyRevolutions.com, as Delacroix's paintings of the Greek struggle are excellent visual representations of the many contradictions embedded within Philhellenism. And then, along with these visual representations, the Italian Romantic composer Giacchino Rossini premiered his opera, The Siege of Corinth, in 1826, which depicted a 15th century Ottoman siege of a Greek town, but which quite intentionally evoked the contemporaneous siege of Missolonghi, as the opera ended with a dramatic scene of mass suicide and was infused with messages of Greek freedom from Ottoman oppression. And when Rossini's opera premiered in Paris, it created a sensation across France in 1826, just a few months after the siege of Missolonghi had ended in catastrophe for the Greeks. All of this outpouring of support for the Greeks made it increasingly awkward for the governments of the great powers, specifically Great Britain, Bourbon France, and Tsarist Russia, because they all had as their official policy not only supporting the Ottoman Sultan, but also just a general opposition to revolutions of any kind. However, those sympathizing with the Greeks were no longer just like the carping liberals and romantic nationalists who had all been squashed by Metternich after Napoleon's defeat and after the Bourbon king was restored to France. Even conservatives in some of the highest posts of government were now getting on board, with probably the two most significant figures being the Foreign Secretary and eventual Prime Minister of Great Britain, George Canning, and then Alexander I, the Tsar of Russia himself. These two figures were stalwart conservatives, but they both harbored sort of secret sympathies for the Greeks, and such sympathies would slowly turn events in favor of the revolutionaries. During the mid to late 1820s, there was a very, very subtle shift taking place in the norms of great power diplomacy. Basically, Tsar Alexander was at this point becoming ever more impatient with Metternich and his excuses for doing nothing for the Greeks. Because remember, Russia historically saw itself as the natural protector of Orthodox Christians, and the Tsar had initially shown his sympathies for the Greeks all the way back in 1815 at the Congress of Vienna that originally established the conservative order of post-Napoleonic Europe. What this meant was that the Tsar was refraining from helping the Greeks basically just because Metternich told him not to help them. However, as its most powerful member, Russia was the key to Metternich's Holy Alliance, and the Tsar knew it. So, as stories of the mass enslavement and mass murder of Orthodox Christians at the hands of Ibrahim Pasha were filtering back to Russia, the Tsar was beginning to see Metternich's endless excuses as ever more flimsy. The British Foreign Secretary, George Canning, had gotten wind of the Tsar's impatience with Metternich and had decided to try and take advantage of the Tsar's change of heart for a few reasons. First, Canning really did sympathize with the Greeks, and he himself had some abolitionist tendencies. Second, he sought to break up the Holy Alliance and to end their stronghold on continental Europe. But he wanted to do this in a way that would check Russian power. So, when the Greeks appealed to the British for help at the onset of Ibrahim Pasha's devastating campaign, Canning sent his cousin to go check out what was going on down in Greece. And while there, Canning's cousin made contact with Mavrokordatos and then personally witnessed some of the atrocities being committed against the Greeks, all of which he reported back to George Canning. Canning then approached the Tsar, reporting to Alexander that the Greeks had asked the British for help and that things were worse for the Greeks than many had even imagined. Canning then secretly proposed that Russia and Great Britain act as mediators on behalf of the Greeks to help bring an end to this now endless war. This all caught the Tsar at just the right moment because, as we said, he had been growing impatient with Metternich. And the Tsar was also just kind of getting jealous of the fact that the Greeks went to the British instead of to him, their great Orthodox father, for help. Because of this, the Tsar agreed to Canning's proposition in the summer of 1825. All of this was done very secretly, though, because if news of this partnership in support of the Greeks reached Metternich in the wrong way, it could very well blow up the entire Holy Alliance. So things just kind of bubbled under the surface for a while until later that year, in December of 1825, when Tsar Alexander suddenly died, and he was succeeded by his son, Tsar Nicholas I, who was potentially even more supportive of the Greeks than his father, and he was also much less committed to appeasing Metternich. All of this culminated in April of 1826, when Great Britain and Russia approached the Sultan with a proposition to end the war by establishing Greece as an autonomous province whose only tie to the Sublime Porte would be a yearly tribute. Basically, they were proposing that Greece become an Ottoman suzerainty like Serbia or like the Danubian principalities. Then France got wind of all this and thought, well, you know, we might as well get on board with this little adventure and see what we might be able to snatch away from the Ottomans in the process. And so was born the incredibly consequential 1827 Treaty of London, in which Britain, France, and Russia all committed to achieving Greek autonomy. Though they were still promising that the Greeks would remain at least nominally under Ottoman control. For now, the three powers were saying that they were committed to doing all of this peacefully. However, the treaty also said that if the Sultan refused their offer, an allied naval force would intervene in order to bring an end to the war. It was kind of inevitable, though, that the treaty would prompt a crisis leading to this naval intervention because, One of the stipulations was that Greece would get a seat at the negotiating table with the Sultan, and everyone involved knew that the Sultan was bound to reject this idea. And indeed he did. So, in late 1827, an allied navy of combined British, Russian, and French forces set sail across the Mediterranean with the purpose of putting an end to hostilities between the Greeks and the Ottomans. Even though the Treaty of London was structured in a way that was kind of bound to end in hostilities, the British, for their part, were honestly trying to avoid a war, because a war could only mean one thing: further Russian expansion at the expense of the Ottomans. Because George Canning and the British, as well as the French, understood this fact quite well, language was inserted into the treaty to prevent this expansion from happening. The treaty specifically made Russia promise to not attempt to expand their territories at Ottoman expense should a war break out. And in many ways, the Treaty of London happened because Great Britain and France began to understand Greek independence as an inevitability, and George Canning was savvy enough to try and control this process in a way that would protect British interests by making sure that Greece did not simply become a client state of the Russian Empire, something that was a very real possibility. Even with this goal of avoiding hostilities, though, the language of the treaty would leave the admirals of the Allied Navy with their hands tied, and would create a situation in which fighting was inevitably going to break out. So, in August of 1827, less than a month after the Treaty of London had been signed, the Sultan officially rejected the treaty, and then, a few days later, the Greeks accepted it. Though before his formal rejection of the treaty, the Sultan had hoped to head off the impending intervention, and so he had arranged for a joint Ottoman-Egyptian fleet to set sail from Alexandria, and the Sultan's fleet reached the Bay of Navarino on the southern end of the Peloponnese in early September. Shortly thereafter, an allied fleet of British and French ships arrived just outside of the bay with the purpose of preventing any further movement of the Ottoman fleet. Then, the British and French admirals personally came to Navarino to meet with Ibrahim Pasha. And this was an incredibly delicate situation for Ibrahim, who was not simply fighting on behalf of the Sultan, but was primarily looking out for the interests of his father, Muhammad Ali, back in Egypt. When the Treaty of London had originally been signed, Muhammad Ali had tried to make the Sultan see that the Europeans were not messing around with this treaty, but Sultan Mahmud would not give way. This left Muhammad Ali between a rock and a hard place, as he, on the one hand, still hoped to remain on good terms with the Sultan, but on the other hand, he had very close ties with the British and the French, who had been instrumental in helping him to build his modernized army. Understanding quite well the delicate situation he found himself in, Ibrahim Pasha agreed with the Allied admirals to pause hostilities while he reached out both to the Sultan and to his father in Egypt for new instructions. However, during this waiting period, there were a couple of incidents that occurred which revealed how the sides just had very different understandings of what had been agreed upon in the armistice. Ibrahim had gotten word that Greek ships were still conducting operations off the coast of mainland Greece, so the Pasha sent some of his ships from Navarino to go and stop them. He was able to get through the Allied blockade mainly because the Allies had temporarily put their guard down after their agreement with Ibrahim. Well, the British admiral was furious when he got word of this, and he sent out several ships to go stop the Ottomans and bring them back. Then the admiral also received intelligence that Ibrahim's forces had taken the plains of Kalamata, signaling that he was still carrying on his land operations in the Peloponnese. When the British admiral protested these actions, Ibrahim pointed out the fact that the Greeks had not quit their hostilities, and he couldn't afford to just lay down his arms when he was still being attacked. But the result of all this was that the relationship between Ibrahim and the Allied commanders quickly began to sour. And the British admiral was also receiving reports from agents in the Peloponnese of Ottoman atrocities,
and just the general malnutrition, disease, and starvation of the Greek population due to Ibrahim's destruction of the countryside. All of this led the British admiral and his confidants to increasingly believe that Ibrahim was executing a war of extermination against the Greeks, and that if the Allies did not intervene soon, there would simply not be any Greeks left to save. This belief on the part of the British admiral really reveals the impact that the overwhelming international popular response in support of the Greeks had on events. The admiral claimed that he was not himself a Philhellene, and that his only priority was furthering the British national interest. However, the narrative of Greek extermination at the hands of the Ottomans had been a central part of the humanitarian effort of the Philhellenes, best seen through the melodramatic works of art depicting Ottoman atrocities. Ibrahim Pasha was absolutely waging a war of terror and destruction against the Greeks in order to sap their will to continue fighting. However, it is not at all clear that the Ottomans had, like, the extermination of the Greeks as a goal. They simply wanted the Greeks to submit to the Sultan and have the territory and people of Greece be brought back under Ottoman sovereignty. Nevertheless, the British leadership at Navarino believed that Ibrahim meant to put an end to the Greeks as a people. Weighing all of their options, the admirals of the Allied fleet decided they had no choice but to try and force Ibrahim to end hostilities, and they entered the Bay of Navarino in October of 1827. And then, as so often happens with these sorts of things, the first shot of the battle went off by accident when a British ship approached an Ottoman vessel to ask them to simply move their position. But their approach was mistaken by the Ottomans as an attack, and so they were fired upon. Events then quickly took on a life of their own, and a full-on naval battle ensued involving hundreds of ships and several thousand sailors. The Battle of Navarino holds a special place within naval history, as it was the last major battle fought entirely using sailing ships, so it represented the end of the great sea battles that had defined the Napoleonic Wars. The battle did not last long, however, as the superiority of the combined British, French, and Russian navies became quickly apparent, and they devastated the Ottoman-Egyptian forces. Because the Ottomans had been using Navarino Bay as the center of their naval operations, this defeat meant that nearly the entire Ottoman-Egyptian navy was now sunk as a result of this battle. They still had a few ships here and there, but for all intents and purposes, the Ottomans were now fully unable to exert any sea power whatsoever. For the Greeks, the news of the Ottoman defeat at Navarino was nothing less than miraculous. The Greeks had been getting trounced, and now the war was basically about to be over because the Sultan knew he could not take on a combined Russian, French, and British force. The Ottomans were now cornered, and the war, which had been dragging on for over 6 years, was coming to an extremely abrupt end. The Greeks had finally been able to achieve the great power intervention they had sought from the very, very beginning, when Alexandros Ypsilantis and the Etairia had invaded the Danubian principalities way back in 1821 with the hope of provoking Russian involvement. It had taken 6 long years, but with the British, French, and especially Russians on their side, Greek victory was now inevitable. But, like, what does this all really mean? Yes, victory was now an inevitability, but what would Greece look like after this victory was secured? Would the Greeks be autonomous while remaining under nominal Ottoman authority? Or would they be a truly independent nation? And who would even rule the independent Greeks? It's not like there was any sort of legitimate government to speak of. I mean, haven't we spent the last several episodes belaboring the point that the Greeks had no real central government and were essentially made up of hundreds of armed bands constantly at each other's throats? Well, the man who would step into the void that was post-revolutionary Greek politics would be our old friend Yiannis Kapodistrias. Now, you may remember Kapodistrias from way back in episode 3, our first episode on the Greeks, when we introduced Kapodistrias as the Russian foreign minister who refused the leadership of the Phliki Etairia when they approached him in 1818. Well, in the meantime, Kapodistrias had kind of just been doing his thing, serving the Russian Tsar while always secretly harboring aspirations to one day return home to become the leader of an independent Greece. So when the Greek National Assembly elected him as their first head of state in early 1828, he was ready and waiting. Now, Kapodistrias is an interesting dude because he did not immediately flock to Greece when the revolution began, as so many of his compatriots had, who were all similarly part of the European Greek diaspora. Like the Ypsilantis brothers, and like Mavrokordatos, who had all joined the revolution early on, Kapodistrias was also from an illustrious and aristocratic Greek family. But due to his high position within the Russian diplomatic service, being the foreign minister of Russia when the revolution began, Kapodistrias had had to tread much more carefully than his other fellow Greek aristocrats. Kapodistrias had actually seen his career take a turn for the worse during the revolution, as he was basically forced to take a leave of absence from his post as foreign minister, because the Tsar at that time still needed to uphold the appearance of supporting the Sultan against revolutionaries. But after being forced to leave his Russian diplomatic post, Kapodistrias would still only support the revolution from afar by going around Europe and using his connections to gain sympathy for the Greek cause. So when Kapodistrias arrived in Greece in January of 1828, he was unique amongst the Greek leaders in that he was not a fighting man and had taken no active part in the actual revolution. In the long run, this would both hurt him and help him, as he was able to somewhat stand to the side of the fractious infighting that still lingered. But at the same time, he got a lot of side eyes from Greek revolutionaries who saw him as a foreigner who meant to make himself dictator of Greece. For the time being, though, all sides believed that Kapodistrias had the support of the three great powers behind him. This was not fully true, as his relationship with Britain, France, and Russia was at this point fairly complicated, but none of that really mattered because everyone in Greece believed that he had been sent by the Allied forces. The Greek warlords knew that they could never dream of facing off against the great powers of Europe. So, for the time being, they held their tongues and listened to Kapodistrias, going along with his plans. For now. But boy did Kapodistrias have some challenges ahead of him. He was taking the leadership of a country completely devastated by years of revolutionary and civil wars that had basically stopped all normal economic activity. The population of Greece had been hit hard by war, disease, malnutrition, starvation, and enslavement, and the primary way that leaders within the Peloponnese, Western Greece, and the Greek Isles now made money was through banditry, highway robbery, and piracy. So Kapodistrias had the extremely unenviable task of putting an end to these nefarious activities, which had at this point become the main source of income for the powerful warlords and elite notable families. As you might expect, this quickly made him unpopular with these powerful Greeks, and he began to be painted as a tyrannous despot who wished to make himself a king. Kapodistrias, for his part, did have some centralizing tendencies and was certainly no democrat, but it is also clear that he did not want to be a king. Rather, he came to the not unreasonable conclusion that the country he was leading was a complete wreck, primarily due to the fact that it was being run by like dozens of different regional leaders who are constantly trying to undermine each other. I mean, you can't really blame the guy for trying to insert some sort of central authority into the picture. Now, for better or for worse, Kapodistrias did have a lot of help from the great powers in his project to rebuild the Greek nation. The French would embark on a years-long expedition into the Peloponnese to expel the last of the Ottoman forces and to help modernize the infrastructure of the peninsula. Like the earlier French expedition into Egypt, this also included archaeological and scientific projects that would mark the beginning of Greece's long and complex relationship with Western Europe over ownership of their national treasures from the classical Greek past. The French expedition into the Peloponnese was also a training ground of sorts for the later, much more consequential French expedition into Ottoman Algeria. And then, of course, Navarino led directly into a massive war between the Ottomans and the Russians, which, you know, like everyone was trying to avoid, but which everyone kind of knew would happen anyways. The Russo-Turkish War of 1828-1829 was a big old war that ended with an unequivocal defeat for the Ottomans, and many Greek revolutionary volunteers helped the Russians ensure their victory. The result of Russian victory and Ottoman defeat was that the Russians, even though the French and British had tried ever so hard to prevent it, would yet again expand their territory at the expense of the Ottomans. Specifically, they would occupy the all-important Danubian principalities of modern Romania, where the revolution had been launched way back in 1821. The principalities would remain nominally under Ottoman control, but the Russians would exert more and more influence there over the following decades. More importantly for our Greek revolutionaries, however, was that at the end of the war, the Sultan was forced to finally recognize Greece as an independent nation. So the Greeks were truly, truly independent now. No strings attached, huh? Well, not so fast. The involvement of Britain, France, and Russia would color the early politics of the Greek nation to such an extent that the three rival political parties that emerged in Greece were simply called the Russian Party, the French Party, and the British Party, because they were all most defined by their alignment with the different great powers who were still very much present. And then, in 1832, the three great powers met in London and decided on a king who they thought would just be perfect for the Greeks. The Greeks themselves had very little say in the matter, so Otto, a Bavarian and Catholic prince, yep, that's right, he was a Catholic, was crowned king of Greece, land of Christian orthodoxy, even though he had, you know, never stepped foot in Greece in his life. But this is kind of just how things went when the great powers decided to get involved. So what's happened to poor old Kapodistrias? Well, just about a year before King Otto came into the picture, Kapodistrias, as we said, was trying to clamp down on piracy and banditry. Well, one notable family whose well-being was completely dependent upon such activities began preparations for a revolt against the Kapodistrias government, and so Kapodistrias was forced to arrest their great patriarch. This was one step too far, and the patriarch's son and younger brother jumped Kapodistrias while he was entering a church service and assassinated the Greek governor. This assassination launched Greece into a period of light anarchy as armed factions began facing off once again. Though things did eventually simmer back down once King Otto was brought in by the great powers. But these tensions would continue to simmer for a very long time. Now, after independence was won, a handful of our old friends from the revolutionary days did continue to play a role in charting the future course of Greece. The great revolutionary cleft, Theodoros Kolokotrones, and the Philikia Tyria military leader, Dimitrios Ypsilantis, would both, for their part, offer early support for Kapodistrias and later for King Otto as leaders of the Russian party. In opposition to them would be the wily political survivor, Alexandros Mavrokordatos, who would emerge as the leader of the English party, and Mavrokordatos would outlast many of his revolutionary rivals, Kolokotrones and Ypsilantis chief among them. Over the following decades, Mavrokordatos would serve as a diplomat, as minister of finance, and several times as prime minister, remaining very influential during the first 30 years of Greek independence, up until his death in 1865. And in many ways, Mavrokordatos would stamp the early history of modern Greece really more than any other revolutionary leader. And so, even though there would be some growing pains, and the great powers were always kind of lurking in the background, the Greeks had achieved the impossible. They were not some autonomous principality owing tribute to the Sultan. They were now the Kingdom of Greece, and they were truly independent. This was a big deal, and it would serve as inspiration for many revolutionary nationalists still under the Sultan's thumb, but wishing to break away completely. But next time, we will leave our friends in Greece behind, though they will be coming in and out of our story quite often. and we will head to Egypt as we take a deep dive into the rise of Muhammad Ali, who is at this point preparing to take advantage of all these recent Ottoman losses as he would declare war on the Sublime Porte and eventually begin to eclipse even the Sultan himself as arguably the most powerful leader in the entire Ottoman Empire.